Right, our reading this morning comes from Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 28. Like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around it. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one speaking. And he said to me, "Son of man, stand on your feet, and I will speak to you." Then the Spirit entered me, and he spoke to me, and set me on my feet, and I heard him who spoke to me. And he said to me, "Son of man, I am sending you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. For their impudent and stubborn children, I am sending you to them, and you shall say to them, 'Thus saith the Lord God.' As for them, whether they hear or whether they refuse, for they are a rebellious house, yet they will know that a prophet has been among them. And you, son of man, do not be afraid of them, nor be afraid of their words. The briars and thorns are with you, and you dwell among scorpions. Do not be afraid of their words or dismayed by their looks, though they are a rebellious house. You shall speak my words to them, whether they hear or whether they refuse, for they are rebellious. But you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Do not be rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you." And then chapter 3 and verse 16. "Now it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore hear a word from my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, "You shall surely die," and you shall give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked ways, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. Again, when a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because you did not give him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness, which he has done, shall not be remembered, but his blood I will require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live, because he took warning also, and you have delivered your soul."
Thank you. Last week, Tim explained the background of the prophecy, how Ezekiel was near Babylon, hundreds of miles away across the desert from where he came from in Jerusalem, where he was a priest. These two chapters that we've read parts of describe his commissioning. Twice it mentions in these two chapters that he saw the glory of the Lord. It's a frequent theme in the whole book of him seeing the glory of the Lord. And he falls to the ground. I think if we truly experienced God's presence, it would humble us too. We often wonder when we think, well, why would seeing such a, what might be an amazing thing, make you fall to the ground? And I was trying to imagine a sort of way in which it would be something that I would understand other than literally seeing the glory of the Lord. But I imagine that in the light of God's glory, truth, that it effectively exposes me for everything that I am. And I guess it would be like if there was a visual recording of every one of our deeds and a visual recording of every one of our thoughts, and you were standing before a judge in a court, and everybody in the court could also see all your words and deeds, and probably beforehand you probably thought, because you couldn't remember them all, but the video recorded them all, that, well, I've done some good stuff, or that the good would outweigh the bad. But most of us know, when we read the newspapers or see things on the news about some terrible thing that people have done, said, or even, that sticks with us, and we attribute the bad and the evil to them as summing up their character. And unless we knew somebody personally and thought, well, they were mitigating circumstances, that's what we remember. And our shame for most of us, well, I speak for myself, would be all-consuming, such that I would probably want the floor to swallow me. I'd probably want to lie on the floor in shame and hide. So I think that's probably a little bit of why it had this effect on him. We know it had the same effect on the Apostle John, who, it said, he lay on Jesus' bosom at table at the Last Supper. And yet, when he saw Jesus in his majesty, in his vision, in Revelation, he fell at his feet as dead. So somebody that close, somebody that committed, an apostle, still it had that effect upon him. And indeed, the Apostle Paul, it had that effect upon him too. On the Emmaus road, on the way to Damascus, he was struck to the ground by light from heaven above the brightness of the noonday sun. But what's remarkable is that that's not the end of the story, because Ezekiel was able to prophesy. He was able to speak truth both to power and to people. John did the same, and the Apostle Paul, as we most of us well know, also did the same. So the same is true for us, that we get to the presence of God, realize our nothingness, who we are, and say, Lord, I still want to be used by you, and he will use you and me. Not because we're wonderful, probably because we're bad and we're aware that we're not much use. That when I'm nothing, then God can use me. It's when I am confident and full of my own skills and attributes that God finds it often very difficult to get through to us. The Spirit, it says, raised Ezekiel then to tell him he was being sent as a messenger to his nation, particularly those who were with him in Babylon, because there was quite a company of them living in that area, and he was to preach to them because they were sort of hankering after going back and thought the restoration would come and power would be restored, etc., etc. And it made me think, what makes a true prophet? How do we know if they're just somebody who's self-appointed, that I declare that I am a prophet of God, or that they are truly commissioned by God? And I guess the theme through the Bible, and indeed Ezekiel, was that they speak what they're given to say, despite the cost, whatever the cost. Many of the true prophets suffered serious persecution and even death for their speaking out. Some of them, history, not necessarily in the Bible, but the generally understood, was some of them were fairly gruesome deaths that they suffered at the hands of the people in power. Ezekiel was told that he was going to be speaking to rebellious people who didn't want to listen. The other thing about the prophets, they condemned current behavior But they made promises as well of what God was promising for the future. And I guess if they were prophesying then about events soon to take place, and they took place, you could say, well, they got it right, so they were almost certainly speaking on behalf of God. That's why Jews and Christians keep them as inspired writings. They don't keep the writings, the Jews didn't keep the writings of all the people who got it wrong. They kept the writings of the people who got it right. Blaise Pascal, in his Pensée, has some thoughts about this very subject on why people are prophets and why they're not, and why Jesus was who he said he was. You might say that some of these prophecies were written after the events to make it look as if the prophet was, you know, a prophet and look good. But all of these prophecies, almost all of them, contain future promises that haven't yet taken place. So their confirmation is that they said things would take place, and they did, but they made promises for the ultimate future of humanity, the salvation of humanity, which is yet to take place as well. As well as the birth, death, resurrection of Jesus, also a future kingdom to come. And I also think that the Jews would hardly have been impressed by somebody who wrote history and pretended it was prophecy. You just read the Bible to know that the Jews were very well aware of their own shortcomings. It then speaks about Ezekiel being told in quite an amount of detail that he can't excuse himself from it. Somebody dies in their sins, unrepentant, and he, Ezekiel, has not told them, made them aware that what they're doing is wrong, God would require it. He would be held responsible for that. Likewise, somebody who was acting well as a righteous person and then falls into sin and wickedness, again, if he didn't correct them and tell them that what they were doing was wrong, again, God would require it at his hand. I've commissioned you as a prophet. You don't have an escape. In the New Testament, John the Baptist is a prime example of somebody who Jesus said was the greatest prophet born of women. And he said, and he spoke the truth to power to a wicked ruler. It cost him his life. But his testimony remains to this day. Nathan rebukes David, the king, after his terrible sin with Bathsheba and murder of her husband. He survived, but his testimony is with us in the Bible, and there's many more like them in the Bible and in our own knowledge of history, of the testimony of people who have spoken the truth, preached, despite the consequences for themselves. That's why, if you have good news about Jesus, you sometimes still need to call out evil. Because God would lay it on your heart that you should do so. And I reflected about the current culture that I live in, where I'm as guilty as the worst of thinking that we should maybe just live and let live. My faith is good for me, but should I really sort of be thrusting it down other people's throats? And at the worst, it's, well, if somebody wants to go to hell, that's their choice. But then I reflected would I allow a blind and deaf person to walk off the pavement in front of a speeding car? Or a suicide standing on a high ledge, encourage them to jump? I wouldn't. So if I believe my message is salvation for this life and for eternity, why don't I, like the Apostle Paul, urge people with the seriousness of their situation, but the joy and the opportunity of coming to know Jesus Christ, the one who died for us and who rose and lives for us? Didn't read it, but right at the end of that third chapter, it talks, just after he sees the glory of the Lord again, it says that you'll be put in silence, that you won't be able to speak for a time until God allows you to. And I guess it reminded me of Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, who also had a period of silence where he wasn't able to speak. And again, I was reminded of Ecclesiastes, where it says that there is a time to speak and a time to be silent. And we know from Job that his friends were silent to begin with, and then they wouldn't stop talking, and it wasn't very helpful. So again, there is a time, and I guess the thing that strikes me is, if somebody asks me, or I ask myself, or ask God, well, when should I speak and when should I be silent? I was watching something yesterday where somebody said, well, you need to be in the presence of God frequently, just like you are with your friends, to know them, to understand, and you get an understanding of when you need to speak and when you need to be silent. And knowing God and getting to know him better, we will then have a better understanding of when he needs us to speak up, speak out, or when to be silent. And that only comes with knowing him and experiencing his presence. May the Lord bless the word.